Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are so pleased today to be joined in the studio by Dominique DeAndre, who is the curator of the 1 Minute Play Festival. It's like, my goodness, how does one do that? Well, we don't know. That's why we have them in the studio to talk about that. So, Dominique, while I grab your bio, here it is. You are the founder and producing artistic director of this 1 Minute Play Festival, and this is the third annual. Is it the third annual period or the third annual here in San Francisco?
It's the third annual here in San Francisco. It's, in fact, almost our seventh year in existence. Mm-hmm. And this year we're working in, I believe, 13 different communities and urban centers making the festival. Mm-hmm. And this was San Francisco is always one of my favorite towns to come to because it feels like home. So even though it didn't originate here, it sure feels like it sometimes when I'm here.
Right. Yeah. So this particular festival is special in that not only has it been sold out in the past two seasons, this is the largest, most inclusive, most ambitious collaboration between the Playwright Festival, Playwriters Foundation, and the 1 Minute Play Festival to date. And why don't you tell us how this is the most ambitious? I want to let you give us, like, how many 1 Minute Plays, how many playwrights. Yeah.
Awesome.
And what they're writing about, and how do you do this in 1 minute?
Yeah, sure. I'll give you the whole spiel. So the 1 Minute Play Festival is kind of a way of looking at what is going on in the collective conscious at a given city at a given time. So we invite writers that we source locally in every city we work in that are living and working in the area to engage in this playmaking process where it's about making a really specific theatrical moment. And we don't tell them what to write about, just sort of how to approach writing, which is about building up to a moment that says something rather than cramming a bunch of things in, make it about a clock ticking down. It's really just about what can resonate in an instance. And what we do is we look at the landscape of what comes in and we figure out how and what is being said. And we try to reflect that back to the community, like highlighting any emerging themes or ideas or styles and saying, basically, this is what your artistic community is thinking about and responding to right now. And here's 70 little pulses of storytelling that sort of speak to that. And this year in San Francisco, we really challenged the Playwrights Foundation and the artists to, and everybody, to really think about who is actually living and working here, period. In the past, we've had people that are affiliated or coming in and out of town that were invited to participate in this year. And if you don't have 2 feet in the ground in this area, you can't write. And we also really took the time to think about who what we were including, what voices we were including, who else we need to hear from, what other types of voices are we need to hear from in this sort of collective conscious. And we really made an effort to be as diverse as possible. And the result of that this year is that we have more women than we've ever had before. We have more culturally diverse, more sexually oriented diverse participants, more generationally diverse participants. So if you kind of think of diversity, we've got, I think what we have is a true cross-section of who's living and working here. And I think that's really exciting to hear from voices, all these voices that are kind of in conversation with one another. And this year we're doing 70 brand new 1 minute plays that were written just for this by 40 Bay Area playwrights, staged by 7 directors who are also mostly female, which is really exciting. Mm-hmm. And almost 40 actors. So it's going to be a really big, massive festival, much bigger than we've done in the past, and mm-hmm. that's exciting.
Yeah. So how does that look? The actors, are they an ensemble? They act in all of the pieces where needed?
That's a great question. So directors put teams of actors together that work on several plays.
Okay.
So there's like seven different teams that are performing 10 plays apiece. So 70 plays in total. And choose the order, we choose how the directors are ordered based on how they order. So there's a little bit of a negotiation of what that looks like. And we basically stage them all very simply with four chairs, lights up, lights down. So the focus isn't on a bunch of stuff. It's on the story. It's on the words. It's what's being offered by the writers, and we're really trying to speak to that.
It says in the bio you sent, I mean, it says meet our faculty. Where do you teach?
That's the Primary Stages in New York City. Primary Stages is a big off-Broadway theater, and they have this really amazing education program that does something that no other, they have an approach to the how their philosophy of teaching is and who they're engaging that really no other theater school is doing. It's about who is making the most relevant work and getting those kinds of people to teach, as opposed to like scholarly or professorly types.
And I was reading also in your bio that you are the 2012 New York Theater .com Person of the Year. Congratulations.
Why, thank you.
Well, we are joined in the studio by one of the playwrights. Who's joining us? Is this you, Robert, or is it
I'm
Elizabeth?
Here. This is Elizabeth.
Oh, hey, Elizabeth. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Right.
I know Robert was standing on it, but I don't know what happened.
Oh, well, he might still be popping in. Let me tell our audience a little bit about you. Elizabeth, how do you pronounce your last name, Elizabeth?
Galton.
Previous full-length plays include What the Birds Carry at the Pear Avenue Theater and Dance Lessons at the Working Women's Festival and Venue 9. She has also written and performed solo one-acts in festivals and group shows around the Bay Area. She received her Master's in Fine Arts in Playwriting from San Francisco State University, taught writing for performers at New College, and continues to teach as an artist mentor to graduate students and incarcerated youth. Oh, tell us about your work with incarcerated youth after you finish telling us about this one-minute play that you wrote. A member and resident playwright of Jump Theater Company. Oh, I know Jump. Elizabeth is also a longtime student of poetics with Diana DePrima. Oh, wow, you are just, this is so nice.
I think I was on your show last year with, I don't think that bio mentions, I had a play called Hunter's Point last year.
Yes.
Amethyst, and I spoke to you then.
Right, yeah, because I'm like, I know her. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, great to talk to you again. So tell us about this play.
Well, I have a couple in the show this year. This is my third year doing it.
Oh, you're a veteran. Super.
I guess. It's a really interesting challenge as a playwright. It's to find just that flash of a moment when everything can change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly the way I think about it when I look at it. And, you know, we all have those moments in our life when in the span of 60 seconds, everything changes. And so part of the challenge is to create kind of a theatrical little moment when like the world shifts on its axis. And the first couple of years, the way I approached it was I sort of did a Susan Laurie Park thing of writing one a day for a couple of weeks. Because that gave me the freedom to be horrible and to play and to do something outrageous, you know, and then I would pick a couple to send to them. This year I didn't have the opportunity to do that, but it was interesting because I had a long plane ride and wrote one of them on this long plane ride. So, of course, it ended up being in the exit row of the plane, you know. So, it's kind of whatever kind of happens in your life and bounces in, and that's what you write about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So would it be giving away too much if you tell us what this particular one-minute play is, the title and what it's about?
Well, as I said, I did two Mm-hmm. And
The two. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and one of them takes place in the exit row. It's called Exit Row, and it's like the plane is crashing, and mm-hmm. the person is, and you know, there's three people in the row, and two of them are in a relationship and fighting about why did we have to sit in this row, and oh no, I can't do this, and you know, so it's that kind of a thing. And then the third person shifts everything, changes everything somehow, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was something that was actually based on a story that I went to this cousin reunion in the Midwest, and a cousin told me a story about her father, a time when her father had whipped her. And it wasn't it was the telling of the story that was interesting to me, and I shifted it and put it in a different relationship, and it was the context of the telling of the story that became interesting. So it's a short story that affects this relationship between two people. So mm-hmm. that's all.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So, for the two of you, particularly since you're a veteran, Elizabeth, that's excellent. If you could maybe talk about sort of, I mean, I can't even imagine, seeing all these plays, 70 this time. But in the past, I mean, maybe you were seeing 50 or 40 or 30. I mean, any kind of number over one is big.
Well, it's kind of a wild carnival ride to see them. It's really a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's just like boom, 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 boom. You know, they go by so fast, and there's such a tremendous variety. You know, I mean, Dominic and the Playwright Foundation, they do a really good job of, you know, putting together an interesting group of people, and there's this. Huge diversity, not just in the playwrights, but in terms of what they're talking about and mm-hmm. the stuff. And you're just sitting there going, whoa, 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 you know, these things hit you, and then boom, there's another one, and boom, there's another one. So it is really fun to sit in the audience and mm-hmm. watch it. It is kind of like a carnival ride. There's something new around the corner every 60 seconds. You know?
Yeah. Dominic, you've led close to 30 national festivals in partnership mm-hmm. with, you know, this time the San Francisco Playwrights Foundation. But, you know, you've been all over the place, primary stages, you know, sort of like that's your home, Victory Gardens, Cornerstone Theater Company, Boston Playwrights Theater, Actors Express here, Arts Center, NTAR Theater, Mixed Blood. That sounds interesting. Where are they?
They're in Minneapolis, and they're a theater that's committed to diverse voices, and they have a do-or-die mission where theater tickets to their organization are free because they want to educate and cultivate audiences that should be seeing diverse works instead of having the economic realities of ticket prices. So if their mission fails, the whole theater is going to shut down. They made it a do-or-die mission, so we're supporting that with the festival, raising money for students to come see plays.
Nice. Yeah, and you've worked with Interact Theater, Passage Theater, The Brick, and others. So, where have your festivals taken you? And you know, you're back in San Francisco because it's a place you really like and love a lot. So, this particular season, where are we going thematically?
Thematically. Well, it's interesting to hear Liz talking about everything going boom, boom, boom. And that's sort of how we think of it, too. It's like an evening of pulses. So we try to imagine this as just like a barometer, like sticking a core sample in the earth and looking at a cross-section and just seeing where people are. So the ideas and themes that have emerged are really a lot of things in San Francisco. People are talking about food topics. Organic stuff, local stuff, nutrition. The idea of consumerism and consumption is a big theme this year. Always something that I see in San Francisco that I don't see anywhere else are these themes of technology. Plays about phones, iPhones, apps, and maybe it has something to do with the tech realities here, the tech corridor being here, but there's a lot of play that is about how people communicate or they don't because of technology. how stunted we are in sort of speaking to one another face to face. There are a lot of plays this year that are about loss and death, people recovering from a deep loss. So it's not all like comedy. Some of it really, the writers really take the opportunity to say something about where they are in the world. So these kinds of things, food, consumerism, technology, how we use it, how it's benefiting us or how it's a detriment, how we deal with loss, how we move on. Those are the things we talked about in the festival this year.
So Elizabeth, as a veteran, do you see any themes that are a part of? I mean, do you know about what the other playwrights are presenting? And do you see anything?
No, I don't know until I get there. Well, one of the things that Dominic does is he groups, as he said, you know, there's seven groups of plays. Of 10 plays each, and they go with the director, and he tends to group those by some thread that connects those. So he does a really good job of looking at all these plays and then finding threads. So when he then tells us which group we're in, he sends us the other plays in that group.
Okay.
So that's the first time I see them. You know, and I always read them because that's fun. Otherwise, I have no idea what's going on. But so that he finds, as he says, he finds some threads and then he groups them that way. And then if we can, like I went to a rehearsal for one of my groups. So that's fun also to be able to, you know, go in and see what the director is doing with it. And the directors tend to treat that grouping, they are separate plays, but because there's some kind of thematic connection and because they're the same actors working on those plays, so it's almost like those 10 plays become an act in the evening, and they just run from one to the other almost without break.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So who surrounds you? You read 20 plays because you've got... Unless both your plays are in the same grouping.
I was in two different groups, yeah.
So you have 20 plays, and so not all of them, but who surrounds you with regards to plays, playwrights, themes?
Oh boy, I can't even name the names now. There's so many. I know Chinaka Hodge was, Robert Henry Johnson was in one of my groups.
Okay.
Chinaka Hodge, I know that Aaron Loeb was in one of them, and Brian Thorsten said, it's a wonderful group of playwrights. I feel really honored to be with them. They're you know, amazing playwrights.
I have the list right here.
You have the list.
Dini Chan, you have Chris Chen. You have Joan Holden, you have Robert Henry Johnson, you have Aaron Loeb, you have David Perez, you have Ignacio Zuleta, you have Ben Fisher. So really, really diverse, really different group of people kind of speaking around perspectives on the same ideas. It's just really interesting.
Yeah.
Nice. Oh, that's really, really wonderful. Dominic, I was just looking again at sort of your breadth of your work, and so are you a playwright as well?
You know, I started as a playwright. I do not identify as a playwright any longer because I no longer write plays. But for many years, I worked off and on with Edward Albee, who's a very famous playwright who's a very Virginia Woolf and Pulitzers and Tonys and just like one of our living legends.
Really?
And,
he was
good. I ran out of college. I worked as his assistant, and I was an Albee Foundation Clarion Fellow, and I spent months like writing plays and critiquing them and looking at the work that I was doing. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, I realized that I don't think I could be a playwright. It's really, really hard work, and I'm sure there's just very few people that do it, but it did make me a really good dramaturg. So I work with playwrights. I still do write. I do a lot of applied theater work where I work with different communities and populations, like Liz, incarcerated peoples or at-risk youth populations, or we just did a project with some of the LGBT seniors in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to, work with communities, kind of see where they're at work within their value systems and not prescribe it. And when we do that kind of work, I end up writing a lot if there's a performance. That sometimes that work is not about a performance, it's just about a process of getting people to talk. And now that we do performance stuff, I tend to be writing more, but just really for those groups of people. So really specifically to the project and to the people. I'm never sitting down and facing the blank page and trying to figure out how to say something and articulate it to the wider world like some of these great playwrights in San Francisco are doing. I really just write for a specific place and time.
Maybe we can sort of talk about that a little bit because, Elizabeth, you know, you've done a lot of work sort of writing about sort of disenfranchised communities here in San Francisco. So I was wondering if we could continue with that theme just for a minute around sort of voices and getting people to talk and how theater, you know, just sort of that realm, you know, created that creative realm and artistic realm that's used to get people talking about things that maybe they might not be able to share if they didn't have a character to put it in. So if you could talk about that a little bit. I mean, there are programs like Shakespeare Behind Bars and there's actually the San Quentin Shakespeare program that's hosted by Leslie at the Marin Theater Company. And what was really wonderful, I've gone a couple of seasons, was to see the play. They did Hamlet this season. But it was really great to go back 3 months later and to see the play that they wrote based on Hamlet, where they became the different characters. I'm like, ooh, this is deep. Ooh, whoa. I had to, like, go walk around a lot, you know, after I heard these stories. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's an amazing process. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm sure Dominic could speak to that well. I mean, I know one of the groups that I work with is Each One, Reach One, and they do work in the Juvenile Justice Center here in San Francisco. And, you know, so these are teenage, well, I've only worked in the boys unit because that's been in the city. They do work with girls down in the peninsula. But they have a rule. They create short plays, and they can only use animals or inanimate objects as their characters. Mm-hmm. And it forces them to move into the world of metaphor, and partly it's also a way around the rules of the institution, which are they can't talk about drugs or gangs. Mm-hmm. So, but it makes them do that artistic process that you take these issues and things that you're struggling with, and you put them into the world of fiction, and you use metaphor, and through that you're transformed. And I mean, I've certainly seen that in my own life when I've written about things that had some basis in something that I was struggling with. But when I create a fictional character in a fictional world, I'm able to actually go deeper than if I was dealing in, quote, fact, unquote, if I was writing an essay. And I think that's what a lot of people learn, that and especially when you're creating a character on stage and then you see an actor playing that character, and there's a way that that's transforming and healing on a really deep level for the playwright. So I think that work is really amazing to be doing in all sorts of community settings. I did this project, you know, last year in the Tenderloin, and I'm going to be continuing. I just was amazed at some of the people I met living in SROs, and which, even though it's ostensibly not an institution, it certainly feels like it. And I would want to be doing work with older women living in SROs. So, you know, it's interesting work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure Dominic has even more.
Yeah, Dominic?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't work on the ground that much here in San Francisco, except for the festival. So all these things that I'm hearing about sound really amazing. And I do see some commonalities between this really amazing program you're talking about with having youth write through the lens of animals and metaphor in that realm. And what's so amazing about that kind of work, too, is that when you do something like that, it creates a buffer
for the youth to kind of explore things through. It's a safety. It doesn't put it on them. It puts it on a structure where they have the sort of freedom to examine their issues from a distance rather than making it about themselves in a way that can be really exposing and dangerous, mm-hmm. but rather gives them the tool to kind of look at things objectively, or at least having that opportunity to do so. The work we do with the Women at Play Festival is really related to these types of ideas, meeting people where they're at, working within the value system. I never tell the writers what to write about, but we're just sort of looking at what's there. And I think that's a similar approach to how we work with youth populations, or we work in incarcerated populations, to just sort of seeing what's there before you start to act as an artist, kind of laying low and looking at what's being offered, what they care about, what the politics are for them, what's important, and working from that place rather than coming in and saying, here's what I think is important and here's what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's important as an artist to kind of lie low and really listen.
Right.
So we try to do that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looking at, some of the, theaters you've worked with as a director, and one of them is the MCC Youth Theater. Where is that?
That's in New York City, and they work with their educational wing of MCC, which is an off-Broadway theater, and the youth theater essentially taps high school kids to come in and write plays about where they are now, and then they bring a bunch of professional actors and directors in to kind of honor the work that the youth offer to us.
Mm-hmm.
So they get a chance to participate in the process, and they have this really interesting thing of not editing and not prescribing notes and things like that, so they can literally write about anything. If it's vulgar, if it's really uncomfortable, which oftentimes it is, you have to honor what they've offered. And so sometimes that can be really interesting to negotiate.
Hello.
I think Robert has joined us in the last 4 minutes.
Hello.
Robert, is that you?
That's me. Hello.
Hi, Robert. Good morning. Welcome to the show. We've got like 4 more minutes. We've been talking. Dominic and Elizabeth are in the studio.
Yes,
so,
I heard. I've been listening.
Oh, okay. I just...
Hi, Dominic.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Robert.
Hey, baby. How you doing?
I'm good.
So, Robert, you're an award-winning dancer, international choreographer, and accomplished playwright.
Am I really? Wow.
Yeah. I'm just reading your... Yeah. And you also have a theater company that's been doing this wonderful...
Oh, my God. Toast.
Oh, I've seen some of those plays.
So exciting things going on in my life. Wow.
Yeah. So tell us what's going on with this, the 1 Minute Play Festival. What have you created for this season? Because I think you're a veteran, too.
Well, first of all, I was really excited that my name was added to the loop when I was invited to the festival. So I really want to thank Amy Mueller and the San Francisco Foundation for introducing me to Dominic and sort of, officializing that I am a playwright in the Bay Area because, as you know, Wanda, I've lived most of my career as a dancer and choreographer. And, when you are known for one discipline, people seem to want to, at least this is my experience, sort of write you off as, oh, you're making hats now, or oh, you're writing plays now, or oh, you're painting now, oh, that's just your hobby, but you're really a dancer, right? So this has helped me to work on my craft, meet other playwrights, and actually be a produced playwright. I've worked on, about 3 plays, I think, Dominic. Is that right?
Yeah, we put 2 in. You sent me 2 this year.
So this year, I've written something called The Little Play and something else called The Language of Flowers. And all of them were inspired by the San Francisco 1 Minute Playwrights Festival. So I've written them specifically for this festival. So I'm not sure how to talk about the work. because I haven't heard.
I can talk about it. I know Trevor really well. I think what's really interesting about Robert is because he has his dance background. When you read the work that he has offered in the last few years since I've gotten to know him, it feels like there's a sense of movement that's in, like sort of inherent in the way it speaks and feels. So when you read the work, you get a sense that it wants to move. It's not still. And it feels like an amalgamation of poetry and movement and theater, and has a really interesting point of view that not many in the festival have. So it's always an interesting challenge to see how the work that he offers kind of can be in conversation with writers that are writing from different places, people that are writing from deeply experimental theatrical places, or people that are writing stark realism and just creating moments between people. And the work that he offers sort of operates in the realm of metaphor, as I was talking about earlier, quite a bit. And they feel like one of the little play feels like a meditation, which is a really interesting mixed. I think that group is in a group of plays that sort of is acknowledging the form of art itself. So there's a play that there's a comp that's sort of self-conscious this year as well. And I think that his work is being served really well there, and I can't wait to see how it pops.
Yeah, you know, when I wrote the little play, a gentleman, an actor, thespian named Bennett Guillory, told me that there must be a script in order for a play to exist, in order for theater to exist. There must be a writer, and there must be something on the page. And he sort of, you know, looked down on the fact that when people come to the theater and there's no page, that's not theater. Even if something happens and people are pitching in and collaborating in regards to, well, what's going to happen, you know, in 2 weeks or 2 months or an hour, that's not, when the audience comes to view whatever it is that they're doing, that is not a play. And I went away thinking, well, who made him God of the theater? You know? And that play got created. But so, yeah, just like that. I always wanted to explore that in some form of writing, and so that's my nod towards an attempt at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and The Language of Flowers is really a pretty title.
The Language of Flowers, it's inspired by Lorca.
Oh, okay.
And Federico Garcia Lorca.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the question of theater companies who are subsidized by the government and other countries, and especially during like the 30s, but even now, are unable to do like modern work. I mean, there's still places on the planet that's like that. We saw the walls come down in Russia, you know, with that, and the infiltration of Western art coming in to that part of the world has been really exciting for a lot of people. And so I was really interested in the world of a theater company, a nationally subsidized theater company, who is basically stuck in time. And so there is the character Shakespeare, there's the character Romeo and Juliet, and then there's this girl who's obviously a modern woman who has obviously had some brush with love, and Shakespeare is like thorning her and asking her about, you know, love and her philosophy of love. And it's a one-page tragedy, and she sort of has her say. But I was real interested in that. So how do we as people of the new millennium, artists of the new millennium, how do we move forward with our voices? Do we kill Shakespeare? What do we do? I mean, God forbid, I don't think that we will. But that's just sort of my take on things in terms of how do we move out of a Gestapo sort of institutionalized theater, institutionalized world, and we are going into a world order. Yeah, and I wanted to just like write something beautiful and creepy. So that was what I was after.
Nice.
I think you did that.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, let our audience know that we're speaking to two of the playwrights, Robert Henry Johnson and Elizabeth Gelton, and the curator of this third annual Women in Playwriting Festival, Playwright Festival, Dominique DeAndre. And the playwrights, the 1 minute play festival and the Playwrights Foundation are presenting this third annual event of 1 minute plays, and there are 70 of them, and I believe there are 40 playwrights, and it's going to be really exciting. December 15th and 16th at Thick House Theater in San Francisco, and Thick House is located in is that Petrel Hill area of San Francisco?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm looking for the address. If any of you all have it before I can find it, you can.
I don't know.
Oh gosh, I don't see it. Oh my goodness, I'm looking at this.
I'll have it in one moment. It is on. Just a minute. Give me. I know it. I go there all the time. Just a minute. Thick House is at 1695 18th Street.
Right. Okay, thank you so much.
Near 18th and DeHero.
Right. Yeah. And how much are tickets?
They are $18 online,
okay.
Which is a good bargain if you break it down by the play. It's like cents on the play.
Right,
so,
yeah.
So, like 30 cents a play.
Right.
That's awesome.
Right. Well, my next guest is in the studio. I don't know if you know Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, wonderful environmentalist, playwright, revolutionary, and also an educator. Good morning, Rafael.
Good morning. How are you, Wanda?
I'm good. Do you know any of these folks? Do you know Robert Henry Johnson or Elizabeth or Dominique?
No, I haven't had the pleasure.
Okay.
What's happening, Rafael?
Hello, how are you?
Hello.
Okay.
Right. Well, cool. Well, I'm looking forward to an evening of theater. It's going to be a memorable, I'm sure, experience. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you,
Thank
Wanda.
You.
You take good care.
Yeah, Everybody come
Bye.
On to see our show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope to.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Good morning, Rafael. How are you today?
Very well, Wanda. How are you?
Good.
A little frog in my throat, but that's all right.
Oh, yeah. So, was something significant about, I mean, I'm thinking it should be 12-12-12?
Well, that's the feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe,
mm-hmm.
known as the Empress of the Americas, Queen
uh-huh.
of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest icons in the Latino world. And
mm-hmm.
yesterday was her feast day, the 12th of December, and it just happened to be the 12th year of this millennium.
Mhm. Yeah. So what does that mean, feast day?
What does feast day mean?
Yeah, what does it mean, the feast day? Mm-hmm.
It means the day in which something is celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as holiday.
Okay.
A holy day. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And I just love the way you send me poems, you know, the new moons, the full moons, and you sent me a poem for this, this special day, for Our Lady Guadalupe, and so I was wondering if you could maybe share the poem with the audience, and then I will introduce you, and then we could talk about some other things.
Surely. As you know, I grew up in a bilingual, bicultural setting of the border, and so all my works are written in both Spanish and English.
Mm-hmm.
So they stand as one work in two tongues. So, rezo a tonantzin, Tonantzin, madre de todo lo que de ti vive, es, habita, mora, está. Madre de todos los dioses, las diosas, madre de todos nosotros, la nube y el mar, la arena y el monte, el musgo y el árbol, el arco y la ballena. Derramando flores, haz de mi manto un recuerdo, que jamás olvidemos que tú eres único paraíso de nuestro vivir. Bendita eres, cuna de la vida, fosa de la muerte, fuente del deleite, piedra del sufrir. Concédenos, Madre, justicia. Concédenos, Madre, la paz. Prayer to Tonantzin. Tonantzin, Mother of all that of you lives, be well, dwells, inhabits, is. Mother of all the gods, the goddesses, Mother of us all, the cloud and the sea, the sand and the mountain, the moss and the tree, the mite and the whale. Spilling flowers make of my cloak a reminder that we never forget that you are the only paradise of our loving. Blessed are you, cradle of life, grave of death, font of delight, rock of pain. Grant us, Mother, justice. Grant us, Mother, peace.
It's really beautiful. You were going to say something?
Thank you, honey. The word Tonantzin may be foreign to many of our hearers. Tonantzin is a word that comes from the Nahuatl, which is the language of that group of cultures of which the Aztecs were a part. And it literally means mother of us all. And that was the title given to the earth goddess in pre-Hispanic Mexico. So the Tonantzin actually refers to the earth.
So this could really be Earth, the Earth Day, right? I mean, this is the birthday for Earth, the Earth.
Well, in
or
many
celebration,
ways,
maybe?
Because the Virgen de Guadalupe, you know, the appearance of the Virgin Mary in Mexico, was very much related to the Earth Goddess. And she practically took her place and stands for the Earth Goddess in.
Wow. Yeah, and then the wonderful picture that you sent with the poem, describe it for our audience in the parts of it. You've got Our Lady of Guadalupe inside of who is the person that she's sort of in the heart's space.
That's Saint Juan Diego. The story goes, in brief, that that the Virgin Mary appeared to this Indian, newly converted Indian, a very pious young man, and she sent him to tell the bishop to build her a church. And, of course, Juan Diego went to the bishop, as he was instructed by this apparition of this stately woman. And, of course, the bishop had him thrown out. He didn't believe a word he said. So he went back, Juan Diego went back, the Virgin appeared to him, and she told him, well, I want you to take a gift to the Archbishop for me, to the bishop, actually. He was just the bishop at that time. And so she had him gather flowers that were, all of a sudden, there were Castilian roses blooming on the hillside in the middle of winter. And he picked these roses and took it to the lady, and she arranged them on his cloak and said, take them to the bishop for me. And when he came to the bishop, he wouldn't go away till they let him have an audience with the bishop. And he let go of his cloak, and the roses stumbled down, and on his cloak was imprinted the image of the lady. And that's the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe. That act in Mexico.
Right, yeah. Well, let me read a little bit of your bio. As you mentioned, you were born and raised in a bicultural, bilingual environment of El Paso, Texas, United States, and also in Juarez, Chihuahua, Mexico, with a family on both sides of the Rio Grande. You graduated from El Paso High School and joined the U.S. Navy in the Hospital Corps, and served in the Marine Corps with the rank of Staff Sergeant. And at the end of your military service, you attended the University of Texas, El Paso, then Texas Western College of the University of Texas, in pre-med, taking time to attend the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, where you study archaeology and Mexican literature. Now you live in Berkeley. That was a big jump. Let's see. You've taught many, many places, among them the University of Oregon, Western State College of Colorado, Central Washington State University, University of Texas, El Paso as a visiting professor of philosophy, and Eleni College in Oakland, California, where you founded the Department of Mexican and Latin American Studies. You've also taught in public and elementary schools in the Poets in the Classroom program. Your collection of poems, El Asador de Juegos, The Maker of Games, was published by Casa Editorio in San Francisco, 1977 to 1978, and it went through two editions. And you've been nominated 3 times for the Pushcart Prize, so I need to nominate you like another time or two so you can get it. You've had collections of your poetry, your moon poems, published by Pandemonium Press in Berkeley in 2009. You were named the poet in residence at the Oakland Museum of California and the Oakland Public Library under a Writers on Site Award from Poets and Writers Incorporated, and you were chosen for the annual award for literary achievement by Dragonfly Press in 2002. In 2003, you were honored by the National Council of Teachers of English in Annenberg, CPB, for your writing. And you've been named recipient of the 2012 Dragonfly Press Award for Outstanding Literary Achievement, and you currently sit on the Latino Advisory Council of the Oakland Museum of California. And I just thought you'd be perfect to talk about the new beginning and what that means with regards to the Mayan calendar coming to an end on December 20th or 21st, what day is it?
The 21st,
right. What does that mean? So I thought you'd be a perfect scholar, artist, you know, smart person to explain it to us.
Well, essentially, it was that the Mayans of Mexico, way back in the dim shadows of the past, by the observation of the heavens and the invention of zero, calculated an astoundingly accurate calendar that goes back to the dim beginnings and forward into into the future. The set, they set the date of creation of the world in a mythological date that on our calendar would be August the 11th, 3114 before Christ. And that long count, that long calendar, went on with that, with those cycles to end on December the 21st of 2012, which is a period of at least 5,125-26 years in between. So it's an astoundingly long count.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this has captured the imagination of many people, you know, especially in the West. We have a apocalyptic imaginations, and they invented this imagination, invented Mayan prophecies that said that when the end of the long count was reached, the world would end, which is absolute nonsense. There's no there's no such prophecies as anyone in any place that we know of, and the Mayan elders, the Mayan people, are laughing at this thing because there's no such thing. This prophecy just simply did not exist. It's simply the end of a long count.
Mm-hmm.
Other myths or other things that are supposed are alienation of planets that are going to produce some kind of magic energy that is going to bring us to enlightenment, or maybe even destroy the world, or serve. There's all kinds of beliefs on that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, destructions of Earth always sell good, are always good to sell books and sell movies, because we like our adrenaline rushes. Now, it is possible, you know, it is certainly not improbable, that the planets may have, at this point, reached the same configurations as they were in the year 3114 BC, because the movements of the universes are, of course, cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always an ending and returning, and ending and returning. They spiral in time, according to science. So that's quite possible. But that it's going to send any cosmic rays to wake us up, I think, is highly, highly unlikely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are the Mayan communities doing at this time?
The Mayan communities are doing ritual.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing a celebration of the long count, you know, very much like, of course, we did when we turned the millennium on our puny calendar kind of thing. And I have many dear friends who are traveling to Mexico, mm-hmm. to be at the ancient sacred sites to do prayer and meditation and ritual.
Mm-hmm.
See, what it means is that at this point, we reach the end of this long count to begin a new one.
Right.
And it is a very important mark in time. I think it should be marked. Now, the world is not going to end due to any alignment of planets or any such thing, you know. But science does tell us that we are dangerously close to bringing the world to an end.
Really?
And not because of any planets, but
because
we are killing the Earth by poisoning our air, by poisoning the water, by poisoning our Earth, by using unholy fire, so that the crisis is upon us. And the crisis of an economic system that was born of imperialism, that is the economic system of capitalism, that is unviable because it depends upon inexhaustible resources of the earth, inexhaustible hand labor to be enslaved, crazy production for the sake of production, forever expanding markets, voracious and the thing. They just the earth just simply cannot sustain such nonsense. And we are becoming more and more aware of this, so there is an awakening in the air. And I think this is a good time as any to take stock of where we are and really realize the sacredness of the earth and the sacredness of existence and the sacredness of life and wake up from this nonsense that we have been, that has brought us to this point, and truly create a new world, or else we perish if we go in our own, in the same way we have come to in the past.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. There are quite a few celebrations happening next week. Louisa Teach is having a gathering on the 20th, the day before, and. Dance Mission, Chrissy Kiefer, they're doing this really wonderful program, 19th, and the 20th one is going to go into the 21st. People are going to just be there for the, and you know, coming into the next day. So that's going to be really exciting. What do you plan on doing or participating in? Are you traveling to a sacred space in Mexico?
No, because I think that every space upon earth is sacred, no matter how it has been blasphemed. And I will spend it at home in vigil and silence and meditation and ritual and prayer. Celebrating life. Celebrating existence, celebrating the universe, and rededicating myself to the struggle for justice and peace, which is my way of celebrating life.
Yeah.
Plus my art.
Right. Yeah. So, 5,000 plus years ago, when the calendar, this calendar that's concluding and another one's beginning, who put it together and who's doing the next series?
Well, the calendar was figured out by were the priests of that old culture who observed the heavens and figured out the mathematical calculations to measure time so minutely. And so they set this system of reckoning time that is based on celestial movements that don't change, or they change in ways that are mathematically predictable. So that old thing, ancient system will just continue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it will just continue. It will start a new cycle.
So it's self-perpetuating.
Yes.
Okay. That's a great kind of system.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
not
dependent.
To make it so accurate. Yeah. So accurate. That's how they were able to calculate the times in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So that we have records that are dated that are astounding, because there's no question about when some temple was founded or when some king was elected to his office, or because those are recorded in this time that we can ascertain.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Oh, wonderful. And have you already written a poem about it, or is it going to come later?
I think it will probably come because I always write poems for the solstices and equinoxes.
Mm-hmm. Sure do. Yeah. Do you have a poem handy that maybe we could conclude with? My next guest is in the studio. Is it the winter solstice? Yeah, it's the winter solstice. Do you have a solstice poem you could share with us?
Well, what I have instead of... I do have a solstice poem, but I thought that I would share with you
mm-hmm.
an invocation to Ganesh,
uh-huh.
who is the god of new beginnings.
Oh,
and he is the remover of obstacles in our paths
mm-hmm.
and the open of gateways. And
mm-hmm.
I think we should invoke Ganesh to bring in the new era.
Oh, certainly. And I love that poem. I've heard it before. So, Maria, stay in the studio. We're going to hear this poem to Ganesh.
Invocación a Ganesh. Om Shri Ganeshaya Namah. Sentado en el centro, rodeado de calaveras, donde el lazo de los años se anuda, goloso señor, cabeza de elefante, levántate y baila la cuenta nueva. Con tu hacha derrumba los obstáculos a nuestro vivir, pisotea los obstáculos a nuestro amar, y haz dulce el camino nuevo. Que tus familiares el ratón y la rata roen el almacén de las bendiciones. Que tu serpiente hable con tu colmillo en el libro de lo que fue. Escribe lo que pueda ser y de tu caracol sopla el sonido primordial de lo que es. Invocation to Ganesh. Om Shri Ganeshaya Namah. Seated in the center, ringed with skulls, where the noose of years is tied, sweet-toothed, elephant-headed lord, rise and dance the new count. Axe down the obstacles to our living, trample the obstacles to our loving, and make sweet the new path. Let your familiars, the mouse and the rat, gnaw through to the storehouse of blessings. Let your snake speak with your tusk in your book of what was. Write what may be, and from your conch blow the primordial sound of what is.
Hmm. Wow. That was so beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Raphael. I mean, this was just the best answer to my question. Okay. What happens the day after?
Yes. Let us plan on that and make sure it's good.
All right. Well, you take good care. And, you know, wonderful... day of prayer, meditation on the new beginning, which is a great way to think about life. You know, every day is a new beginning, but this is a really special new beginning.
Yes. And maybe we can begin by making the 1 or 2% liable.
Right, yeah. Well, you take good care. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks for your poetry and your wisdom. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Wanda.
You take good care. Peace and blessings. Bye-bye. Good morning, Maria. How are you?
Well, good morning, Wanda. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. It's so nice to speak to you again on the occasion of your really, really fun. This is a really different kind of Christmas album, Christmas at the Oasis. Yeah, it's really lovely. Well, let our audience know a little bit about you, and you're going to be performing this Saturday and Sunday at the Raz Room, which is located in Hotel Nico, 222 Mason Street, and your shows are both at 7 o'clock. And people can visit the RazRoom.com for information about tickets, or they can call 415-394-1189, and see, you are best known worldwide for your 74 mega hit, Midnight at the Oasis.
Uh-huh.
And so Christmas at the Oasis is sort of a play on that. And it received several Grammy nominations and enshrined you forever in the hearts of baby boomers everywhere. And I believe there was a red carpet for you at the Berklee World Music Festival, right?
Yeah, I had a wonderful time doing that. That was a wonderful event, and I'm still touring a whole lot, and so, but I love doing local events, and that was a really soulful one. We had a great time doing that.
Yeah, and then I got a chance to see you at the there was a Weekend of Peace, and you were at that kickoff concert, and that was really wonderful.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that was with my Red Hot Louisiana band. But for my Christmas at the Oasis show, I use what I call my Christmas jazz all-stars. I just been blessed to know some of the best jazz players in the Bay Area. And so when the occasion warrants it, I call them up. And this show in particular is something I've done over the years, because my feeling is that I love Christmas. I love Christmas time. But over the years, I just got so tired of the same old kind of sappy, over-sentimental, kind of smarmy almost Christmas tunes that have pumped at us in the mall and in shops and on the radio and so forth. And as an antidote to that, I have been collecting what I call Christmas tunes for hipsters, and you know, all in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, which is sort of the era that I kind of musically live in more than the present day. Great artists. Some of my favorite artists have put out some wonderful Christmas tunes that are anything but pedestrian and sappy. And people like Bessie Smith had a great song with Christmas at the Christmas ball, and Louis Prima had "What Will Santa Claus Say When He Finds Everybody Swinging?" You know, and just all kinds of cool tunes. Well, of course, the late very great Charles Brown with his classic rendition of "Merry Christmas, Baby," which I just think is the sexiest Christmas song ever, if I was called on to do a show around Christmas time, I would get together with my jazz all-stars and do that. And everyone always loved hearing these songs and saying, "These are so different and nice. Why don't you make a Christmas album?" But I resisted the idea because I thought, my God, every possible artist in the world has a Christmas album out. And I just thought I would distinguish myself by being the one person on the planet that didn't, the one artist on the planet that didn't have a Christmas album out. But about 2 years ago, I was asked to do a Christmas show at the Raz Room, and they told me they were recording the shows for a special broadcast series they were doing, and they asked if they could record the show, so I just for the purpose of the broadcast. So I reluctantly said yes. I don't usually like to do live, you know, because you can't control the recording, mm-hmm. the recording situation, so you never know what you're going to end up with, even if the band played great and you had a good night, you know. So I said, all right, I'll do it. Well, when it was all done, we had a great night there, and the band was just really swinging, and the producer of that broadcast called me up and said, Maria, have you heard this? You want to hear this? I went, no, I don't want to hear it. He pestered me and finally sat me down and said, you have got to put this out as a Christmas album. And I was astounded because the band was playing so good, and it was a live recording, but we didn't have to fix anything in the mix. It was just one of those magic nights. And so I succumbed, and we put out Christmas at the Oasis, and I got to tell you the title, there's a little funny story about that. When we were gathering to go on stage, the guys and gals that were in the band looked at the set list and said, you're not going to do Midnight at the Oasis? And I said, well, no, it's not a Christmas song. We're here to do a Christmas show. And they said, well, but that's your signature song. You've got to do it. What will the audience think? And so they kind of convinced me. And so I said, well, how can I make this? So I sat down, grabbed a piece of paper and a pen, and in 5 minutes I converted Midnight at the Oasis to Christmas at the Oasis, Send Your Reindeer to Bed, you know, mm-hmm. Snowflakes Kissing Our Faces, Traces of Sugar Plums in Our Head, and so forth and so on. It's kind of goofy, but it was fun, and it kind of fit the occasion, and so that became the title of the album.
Right, yeah. Oh, that's a great story. Do you mind if we play that?
Pardon?
Do you mind if we play it for our audience so they can hear?
I would be thrilled for you to play it.
Christmas at the Oasis. Send your reindeer to bed. Snowflakes kissing our faces. Traces of sugar plums in our hair. Heaven's old and a half moon. Everything's aglow. Let's slip off to the North Pole real soon and kick up a little snow. Come on, Rudolph is our friend. He'll light up the way. Come on. Belly dancer, prancer, and you can be my sheep. Attend him, they all send him and jump out his back and call. But you won't need no elves, baby, when I'm by your side. And you won't need no reindeer, no dear, when I take you for a ride. Come on, Rudolph is our friend. Come on, send your crazy little reindeer to bed. snowflakes kissing our faces, traces of sugar plums in our hair. Ooh, come on.
Great. Yeah.
Thank you. I just think the band is just kicking on all the tracks on this record. It's just, it was one of those magic nights. So we're looking forward to doing our shows at the Razz Room again this year. It's kind of becoming a little tradition with us, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about your band. Who's in it?
Well, the band of my Christmas Jazz All-Stars has the wonderful Ruthie Davies on bass. Let's see. Danny Caron is going to be playing guitar on one of the nights. Josh Workman's going to be playing guitar on the other night. Let's see. Who else? Oh, Chris Burns, my right and left-hand man for many years, is going to be on the keyboards. And the wonderful and very swinging Kent Bryson on drums and Tim Devine on all the horns.
Mm, wow, that is your all-star band. Wow, that's going to be really wonderful. They did such a great recording, didn't they?
It's just one of those flukes, you know, and because, believe me, live recordings don't always come out that way, but Joel Jaffe, who owns and is the main engineer at Studio D Recording in Sausalito, he's just my favorite engineer, and he was the guy in charge of doing the recording, so that's in large part why it came out so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did a great job. Yeah. So tell us about some of the other recordings. This is really great the way you did all this research to make it a different type of Christmas album, one that people don't think about, you know, these particular songs, nor do they hear them in their minds played like the way you play them.
Yeah, thank you. They've showed up on different compilations. I mean, that's how I unearthed them all, or most of them. I knew at the Christmas ball because I'm such a huge and devoted fan of Bessie Smith. I knew that song 40 years ago. But, yeah, it's a nice collection of tunes, and it'll add a nice I'm hoping people will come to the show, and they can come to the show, have a nice evening of entertainment, and do their Christmas shopping all at once, because it's available online, but it'll also be available at the show, and it'll be, you know, a cool little stocking stuffer and kind of hopefully add a kind of nice, you know, high-spirited soundtrack to everybody's holiday festivities. But you were asking me about some of my other recordings. Well, I'm proud to tell you that I just did my 40th album. I think Christmas at the Oasis, if I'm counting it right, was my 39th, which came out last year. Mm-hmm. My 40th album came out this September and is a tribute to one of my main influences and inspirations, a wonderful blues woman named Memphis Minnie. If you ask in an audience, you say, hey, who's heard of Bessie Smith? Everybody pretty much raises their hand. But if you say, who's heard of Memphis Minnie? Very many, much fewer people have heard of her. And she deserves a lot more recognition because she was a contemporary of Bessie Smith. She started recording in the late 20s and all through the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But she was she didn't just sing the blues like Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey and some of the other early blues queens. She also played bitchin' guitar and wrote over 200 of her own songs, which are such good songs that artists still record them today. They still resonate with people, and people are still recording them and relating to them today. So I decided it was time someone gave her the recognition she was due, and I called up my various soul sisters in the blues and asked if they would like to participate, and I got Bonnie Raitt, who's just my dearest friend. She's just nominated for a Grammy. I'm very proud of her. And let's see, Rory Block, another really fine blues woman who also plays guitar. I mostly got gals who not only sing the blues but play guitar. Ruthie Foster, who's a newer artist who's just phenomenal. She plays guitar as well. And then the late, very great Phoebe Snow, who I met years ago. We bonded 40 years ago over our love of Memphis Minnie, so I knew I had to ask her to take part in the project. And let's see who else. Oh, the late, great Coco Taylor. And both of Phoebe and Coco Taylor heard about the project a couple of years ago and were enthused and wanted to participate, but Phoebe took ill and she couldn't, and then passed away. And then Coco, unfortunately, got taken ill very suddenly. But we were able, and because she said, oh, I just recorded the Black Rat Swing. I could do that on the project. Mm-hmm. But we were fortunate in able to, in being able to license two cuts, one cut from each of them, of a Memphis Minnie song that they had chosen to do years ago. And it's very fitting that they're part of this project. So the album's called First Came Memphis Minnie, and I understand from my record company that it's at number 4 on the Living Blues charts right now, which is really, you know, makes me proud. And then and I also found out that as a result, I was just nominated in the Blues Foundation Awards for, it's called the Coco Taylor Award, because she won it so many years in a row, they finally named the award after her, and it's for Best Traditional Female Blues Artist. And so I'm honored to be in the company of some of my blues sisters in that nomination. But I just finished a 7-week tour with my Red Hot Bluesiana band, and we went all over the United States and Canada, and people just loved the new Memphis Minnie material, and we got a great response. So, you know, I ain't getting rich making these albums because they're not, you know, top 40 pop music albums, but to get the recognition of my peers and to get the appreciation we're enjoying as we travel around playing this music, I feel it's very important to keep the music of Memphis Minnie and these other early blues artists alive, because they were pioneers. I mean, Memphis Minnie, if you listen to the way she plays guitar, she was obviously the forerunner to R&B, which of course morphed into rock and roll eventually. And what I found out when I started to do research, I mean, I thought I knew a lot about Memphis Minnie, but till I delved into it to do the liner notes and found out something I didn't know, most of her recordings are acoustic. I mean, she started out as an acoustic country blues artist, but she, despite her name Memphis Minnie, she moved to Chicago in the early 30s and soon became the reigning queen of the Chicago blues scene there. And what I found out was she was one of the first artists to decide to plug in her guitar and go electric. And that's the sound that helped form the, you know, Chicago urban electric blues sound, which is what morphed into R&B and then rock and roll. And she had a big hit when she first plugged in her guitar with a song called Me and My Chauffeur Blues, and another one with Black Rat Swing, which is the cut that Coco Taylor does on the album. And I thought it was, the rest of the album is pretty much acoustic, my tribute album, but I thought it was important to include Coco Taylor's cut, because it's a full-on, balls-to-the-wall, electric, high-energy, just, you know, full-on Chicago blues sound, and I thought that was important that we represent that on the album as well. So that's my latest project, and I'm glad people are enjoying it. I guess I'll keep, people say, how long will you keep doing this? I said, well, as long as people enjoy what I do and keep wanting to listen, I'll keep making music, because I'm certainly enjoying myself doing it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I definitely want to listen to this one. I wish I had something I could share with the audience for this particular recording. Wow,
I was hoping they would have sent you one, but I'll get your address, and after I'll send you one.
Okay,
and,
yeah.
Then maybe you can play it another. Do you want to play, since we're in the Christmas vibe, do you want to play another?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Album?
But before we shift back to Christmas at the Oasis, I just wanted to mention, because I'm just looking on your website, that you have these guest musicians, Del Rey, David Bromberg, Steve Frun, Alvin
yeah.
Youngblood Hart, Steve James, and Roy Rogers. Are these are special guests, right?
Yeah, they certainly are very special guests. I mean, all the singing on the album was done by gals because, you know, we're paying tribute to Memphis Minnie. But Memphis Minnie was really smart. She was smart enough to marry not one but several great guitar playing husbands, mm-hmm. and wrote and recorded a lot of duets with them. And on the album are two duets that she did with her husband. Kansas Joe McCoy, and I got the great Youngblood Hart to come into the studio and do two of those Memphis Minnie Kansas Joe duets together, and both of those are on the album. So he's the only guy singing on the album, but he's also playing great guitar, and they all are. And Del Rey is just amazing. She has totally immersed herself in the style of Memphis Minnie, I'll tell you, when she's playing the guitar and I'm singing, we're pretty much channeling Memphis Minnie right into the room. So it's a great pleasure to work with her and make this music with her.
Nice, yeah. Well, I had a question about shifting back to Christmas at the Oasis. The piece G Baby Ain't I Good for You, I don't know that particular one, and I really like and then Boogie Woogie Santa,
yeah,
and then I really like your Merry Christmas Baby too.
Oh, thank
very
you.
Very nice.
Well, thank you. Yeah, well, the late great Charles Brown, I was blessed and privileged to know him and work with him, and both Ruthie Davies and Danny Caron both toured with him for the last, you know, 15 years of his life or so. So
mm-hmm.
that song's very special to us.
Right, yeah. And then the G Baby Ain't I Good for You, where does that particular one come from?
Well, that's a song that years ago, Fats Waller sang it, and some others as well, and I did it as a duet with Charles Brown on a recording I did in the 90s. In fact, it was the last thing he ever recorded, and I that because it says I bought you a fur coat for Christmas and a diamond ring. That's about the only mention of Christmas, but it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous tune.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a nice, mellow love song, and kind of in the same vibe as Merry Christmas Baby, and that's why I included that one. I think Andy Razoff wrote that, who wrote a lot of hits back in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, the album starts out with Sleigh Ride, which is all, you know, instrumental, and I'm like, wow, this is a danceable Christmas
Absolutely.
Album. I mean, you know, the dance floor might be open because people can, you know, it's not just sitting down thinking. You want to get up and move to the different pieces you have on this album.
Well, thank you. And then, of course, Merry Christmas Baby and G Baby Ain't I Good to You. That's good for some slow dancing with
mm-hmm.
Santa after you put the kids to sleep, you know.
Right.
It's just the two of you. So it's just another slant on Christmas. It's just kind of upbeat and kind of more lighthearted. And, you know, you're going to hear all the other songs everywhere else you go. So this
mm-hmm.
is just something different.
Yeah, I wish that, you know how when you go to stores, they pipe in the music? It'd be great
mm-hmm.
if they were piping in your music.
Well,
that would make you probably buy more.
That. There you go. Well, you know, maybe over the year, hopefully over the years, it'll be some kind of underground classic. I'd like to think, you know, like certain things, just there's a season for them and people turn to them, you know. So maybe this will eventually get to that status. I should be so lucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, even your, you know, like Zat, Z-A-T, Zat You, Santa Claus, and then Yule, That's Cool. I mean, you know.
Yeah, it's Christmas music for hipsters. Zat You, Santa Claus was done by Louis Armstrong, and Yule, That's Cool was also done by Louis Armstrong, and it was written by Steve Allen, who is, you know, one of the early hep cats on the scene there. Mm-hmm. And so it's a nice cross section of American music from a bygone, not too bygone era, but you know, it's kind of old school and kind of updated all at the same time.
Well, it shows that you know, cool didn't just come into vogue. I mean, it's cool has been cool for a while.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, the cool people weren't just born. People have been cool for many, 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 many generations.
That's right. And it kind of seems to be my business to keep, you know, shining a little light on the cool people from before who contributed so much to our American musical heritage.
Right. Yeah. That's because you're cool.
Who was the guy that was on the air before I got on? Who was that? A poet? That was a really cool poem.
Oh, that was Rafael Jesus Gonzalez. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's here and lives in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, now he lives here, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So perhaps we'll conclude with the G Baby Ain't I Good For You, because that's the one you said that you and Charles Brown did a duet together?
Yes.
And that was the last recording? No,
yeah,
I know that's not the one.
It's not on this album.
Right.
I did that. The duet version is on another album.
Mm-hmm. Which one?
It's called Meet Me Where They Play the Blues.
Okay. Yeah. So who's doing the duet on this one?
Nobody. I'm singing it as a solo. So why don't you play? I love What Will Santa Claus Say? That's my kind of current favorite at the moment.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll play that after. I think I'll play Boogie Woogie Santa. I'll play that afterwards because I have to upload that into the. I don't have that one ready, so I'll play that one next.
Okay.
So. Let's see. What was Santa say? Okay, I'll play that after this one. So, so I want to let our audience know that we have been speaking to Maria Muldaur, and she is going to be having her Christmas at the Oasis party at the Raz Room, December 15th and 16th, 7 o'clock both days. So you don't want to miss it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Wanda. Thank you for being such a supporter and advocate of my music. God bless you and peace and blessings and all good things in this holiday and in the new year.
Yeah, God bless you too, and good luck on all of your tours. You've got a fundraiser coming up next Wednesday at the
Fox Theater.
Right. Yeah. Do you want to mention anything about that? I don't know the charity.
I'm doing a show at the Freight and Salvage, my same Christmas show on Thursday in Berkeley. But next Wednesday on the 19th, my daughter Jenny Muldaur sings with Rufus Wainwright, and who's the son of Loudon Wainwright and Kate McGarrigle, and has quite a career going. And he does a Christmas benefit every year in honor of his mother, Kate McGarrigle, who recently passed away. And so Jenny's going to be singing with him. She tours with all kinds of people, from Lou Reed to David Byrne to, you know, to Rufus Wainwright. And right now, actually, she's a Ronette. She's singing with Ronnie Spector. Anyway, so they have special guests every year. Emmy Lou Harris is going to be one of the guests, Van Dyke Parks. And I'm going to come and sing a couple of tunes I'm going to sing Bessie Smith's At the Christmas Ball, and I'm going to sing Christmas at the Oasis. I sent them the album, and those are the two they picked. So I'm looking forward to that and to seeing my beautiful daughter, Jenny, and it's all for a good cause. So I hope your listeners can come to one of these shows. And
starting with this weekend. Yeah.
Just kick off your holiday spirit. And the restroom's great. It has great, you know, light food and wonderful cocktails, and it's a great listening room, so I hope to see some of your listeners there.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then, that'd be super. Yeah, and I'm looking forward to I'm trying to catch you at one of these venues before this holiday season has concluded, but it's been really lovely speaking to you, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you, Wanda. God bless.
God bless you, too.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Track, he's got a rhythm in his feet, but nothing in his sack. He's a boogie woogie Santa Claus. Boogie woogie Santa Claus. He's a boogie woogie Santa, and he boogie all your blues away. He lives up in a mountain like a hermit in a cave. He never had a haircut and he never took a shave. He's a boogie woogie Santa Claus. Boogie woogie Santa Claus. He's a boogie woogie Santa, and he boogie all your blues away. Rock, 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 Mr. Santa. Jump, 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 Mr. Santa. Got no presents for your tree, no candy for your sock. But when he starts to boogie, the whole town rocks. He's a boogie woogie Santa Claus. Boogie woogie Santa Claus. He's a boogie woogie Santa, and he boogie all your blues away. Mama, get your hat, put your dress on. We're gonna jump for joy on Christmas morn. It's a boogie woogie Santa Claus. Boogie woogie Santa Claus. He's a boogie woogie Santa, and he boogie all your blues away. Rock, 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 Mr. Santa. Jump, 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 Mr. Santa. track coming down the track. He's got a rhythm in his shoes, but nothing in his sock. He's a boogie-woogie Santa Claus. Boogie-woogie Santa Claus. He's a boogie-woogie Santa. Eddie, boogie all your blues away. Rock, 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 Mr. Santa. Jump, 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 Mr. Santa. Boogie woogie Santa, Eddie boogie all your blues away. Thank you very much.
That's Maria Muldaur from Christmas at the Oasis, Boogie Woogie Santa. And we're going to close with another cut from that particular track. Maria said that this is her current favorite, and that's What Was Santa Say? And, yeah, thanks for joining us at this special time. And we're really hoping everyone has a blessed holiday season and a great new beginning and a wonderful new year. Peace and blessings.
When he finds everybody swinging, oh, what will Santa Claus say? When he finds them sing, sing, singing, oh, down the chimney he's gonna creep with his great big smile, and he's gonna find the kiddies all swinging in the latest style. Oh, 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 what is Santa bringing? Oh, 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 I wonder whether he'll be swinging everywhere in the land. All the kiddies will be singing, howdy, howdy, ho, howdy, hey. What is Santa Claus gonna say when he finds everybody swinging? Yeah! Everybody's swinging.